south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 271, covering the week of July 19th through July 23rd, 2021. Glad to have you back on the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow us on Gab, follow us on Twitter, and like our YouTube page. Of course, our YouTube page is a treasure trove because we have all of our podcasts there, but we also have lectures and our video series, our Abbeville U is what we're calling it, our video series. A lot of good stuff there. We've been producing those over time. So head on over to YouTube and subscribe there. But also our Gab page is now like our Facebook page, and we're slowly growing that audience. We had a pretty substantial audience at Facebook. I don't know if Facebook is ever coming back, maybe, but for right now, and we'll continue to use Gab in the future. So head on over to Gab. If you're not a member there, of course, it is a much more free platform than Facebook and, of course, Twitter, which we're not very active on Twitter. We do some things every now and then, but just not very active. So Gab is really our social media platform now, and consider heading over to Gab and getting on board. It's all free of charge, just like Facebook is, and you'll find a lot more like-minded people there. Also, don't forget to go to abbevilleinstitute.org. Give us an email address. We'll give you a free ebook, Exploring the Southern Tradition. It's a great book by 20 Abbeville Institute scholars. You'll see our new updated page, our web page. It's a little more modern. There are some features on it some people don't like, but there are some great features, some things that we've done, and we've heard some feedback, so we're going to look at some things. But one of the great things about the new web page is the search function, which is a huge function at the top. Some people couldn't find a way to search articles, but now that's there. We also have a nice slot for our Abbeville Academy, which is free of charge to enroll in. Now, you do have to pay for the classes. These are our Zoom webinars that we post there after they're done. So if you miss them, for whatever reason, you can get a ticket, or at least enroll, I should say, in the Abbeville Academy and purchase one of the classes there, and you get it. And of course, you can download it forever. You can watch it. You can download it in MP3 format. It's a great way to do it. I'd highly recommend it. We only have 100 slots for each one of these webinars when we do them, so we always run out of space. But that said, our next webinar is coming up July 28th. It will feature Tom Daniel, who just did our last Abbeville U video on Southern music. So that's going to be the topic, Southern music. He's actually going to preview some things. He's working on a project for us, which I think is going to be just so awesome. Everybody's going to want to read it. But this project, he's going to discuss it in this Zoom webinar. So make sure you sign up for that. We still have a few tickets left for that. So head on over to abbevilleinstitute.org. Get on that email list. You'll get the email. This is how we market that. We don't put it on the website because we do that through email. We want to go to our subscribers only to get that. But you also get our daily dose of Dixie if you subscribe to the email, so that's a great way. And of course, remember that we exist on your generous contributions alone. So if you like what we do, click on that donate button at abbevilleinstitute.org. You can donate monthly, annually, or a one-time gift. All right, well, all that said, maybe you're at the summer school this week. We did have our summer school July 18th through the 22nd. So that was a grand time. Hopefully, if you went there, you had a good time. If you didn't, maybe next year. So we always enjoy doing the summer school. And next year might be a pretty interesting one because it will be the 20th anniversary of the Abbeville Institute. So that is going to be pretty amazing. And hopefully you will partake in that. We might try to do something special for that next year. Plans are still being made, so just keep on a lookout for that. But we did have some good stuff this week at the Institute. That is something I do want to address, of course, our weekly material. And if you're not getting that daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday, you're missing out on the stuff that goes on the web. So let's talk about the week that was at the Institute. And it had a pretty interesting theme, I should say, and consistent theme. And that theme would be the betrayal of the South by the Republican Party. Now, what would you expect? First of all, the Republican Party has never been interested in the welfare of the South, ever. From its inception, there was nothing remotely interested in the South in any way. I mean, even if you divorce the issue of slavery, which we do here, we don't think that's a true and valuable part of the Southern tradition. But the other parts of the Republican Party, I mean, it was a nationalist party. When I say that, they're interested in a northern-dominated union, finance capital, anti-agrarian at least. Now, they didn't say they were, but this is where the populists in the Midwest come from when they start thinking, whoops, we cut a bad deal with these Republicans from the Northeast, and they started breaking off and forming, helping to form the People's Party in the late 19th century. But certainly the Republican Party has always been hostile to the South. And the only reason Southerners vote Republican is because they really don't think they have anywhere else to go, that the Republican Party is somehow conservative. But as the pieces all point out this week, that is a mirage. The Republican Party will always stab you in the back. There's nothing conservative about it. Now, you could pick a few people here and there that are pretty good and will do the right thing. But for the most part, that's not going to happen with the Republican Party. Southerners in the Southern tradition doesn't really have a political home. And so here at the Institute, of course, we try to understand this. Where does this come from? Where does the Southern betrayal happen? I mean, where do Southerners start fitting in or with the Republican Party? And why did they go to the Republican Party? Or we start looking at things, you know, what is the Republican Party? And does it really represent any interest for the Southern tradition or Southern culture? We seek to understand these things. We seek to understand what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. And in that way, there is a political side of that, too. The Jeffersonian political side that, of course, we like to talk about on this particular podcast and also at the website. But I want to start with Boyd Cathy's piece for Monday because it's really good. And I'm going to read this entire piece because I think that it summarizes very nicely what's happened to the South over the last 50 years or so. And I think that's the key to understanding what happened from 1960 or 60 years. What happened from 1960 to 2020, last 60 years? He says, many Southerners are familiar with James Ron Kennedy and his brother Walter Donnie Kennedy, who are prolific writers and staunch defenders of what is left of the Southern tradition and heritage. Among the titles of their books are most notably The South Was Right, Punished with Poverty, and Yankee Empire, all strongly recommended to those interested in how their heritage and traditions have been subverted and devastated by the forces that dominate modern America, and just how possibly a revival of that heritage and those traditions might occur. But only, if Southerners begin to understand how we reached our present disastrous state of affairs. The task of understanding has been and is incredibly difficult, and it has much to do with the present politics of the former Confederate states and the fact that good intentions and normal reactions to adverse conditions can lead to bad results. How we got here, a comprehension of how we arrived at our present woeful situation, demands that we understand the lineaments of post-war between the states history, in particular the choices our ancestors and we have made. After Appomattox and the other Confederate surrenders, the South, the former Confederate states, experienced first occupation, then Reconstruction, eventually coming out from under those onerous impositions in virtual poverty and shorn of most of its political influence that they had prior to the war, most Southerners naturally inclined toward the Democratic Party. Indeed, it had been the Democrats, including many in the North, who had either opposed the war on the South or at least advocated more reasonable and, if it were, softer policies after the war's conclusion. The Republican Party was seen, rightly so, as the party of conquest, of harsh Reconstruction policies and anti-Southern bigotry. Not that it was in principle necessarily pro-black or favored expansive civil rights measures, only when directed at the conquered South were such actions merited, certainly not at home in their northern bastions. And this is true. I mean, I think he's pointing out, you know, Northerners were perfectly fine with systemic, what the left would call systemic racism in California. They were perfectly fine with Jim Crow or segregation in northern states. They didn't care. But when it came to the South, because that meant votes, this is why they looked at it. The South, the states of the former Confederacy had thus became uniformly Democratic strongholds, a solid South. And growing up in rural North Carolina, how many times did I hear my elders declare I'd vote for the town drunk if he ran on the Democratic ticket? Voting straight party became second nature to Southerners. Granddad had done so. Indeed, some of us had grandparents even born in the 19th century who knew and heard from their parents about the barbarity and degradations that came after 1865. Thus, the Democratic Party became a kind of refuge for most Southerners. And Northern Democrats, at least for a goodly part of the century after Appomattox, welcomed them and allowed them to occupy positions of authority. Even under such social liberals as Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, Southern salons and Congress remember Senators Harry Byrd Sr., Josiah Bailey, Richard Russell, and others who controlled the U.S. Senate and Senate committees, and thus legislation, and not to mention the various Southern congressmen who dominated equally in the House of Representatives, held a considerable amount of power. Of course, both Northern Democrats and their Southern allies had to find compromise at times. Generally, the Northerners let the South alone in its local governing as long as Southerners generally supported measures nationally for their brethren advanced, that their brethren advanced. Along with the occasionally troublesome collaboration, Northern Democrats and Northern folk in general agreed to let the South celebrate its history and its heroes and its heritage. As Professor Clyde Wilson and others have described it, the years between the end of the 19th century and the election of Lyndon Johnson were a kind of second era of good feelings for the South. Southern honor, Southern heroism, Southern history and heritage were celebrated, not just in the South, but everywhere in the nation. Summing up the view of most Americans of that period, President Eisenhower spoke admiringly of General Robert E. Lee, and he was in many ways expressing the general view of most Americans of the South back in 1960. General Robert E. Lee was, in my estimation, one of the supremely gifted men produced by our nation. He believed unswervingly in the constitutional validity of his cause, which until 1865 was still an arguable question in America. He was a poised and inspiring leader, true to the high trust reposed in him by millions of his fellow citizens. He was thoughtful, yet demanding of his officers and men, forbearing with captured enemies, but ingenious, unrelenting, and personally courageous in battle, and never disheartened by reverse or obstacle. Through all his many trials, he remained selfless, almost to a fault, and unfailing in his faith in God. Taken together, he was as noble as a leader and as a man, and unsullied as I read the pages of our history. I mean, let me stop there for a second. Imagine anyone saying this in 2020, 2021. Imagine any politician saying this in 2021 on a national stage. You might find local politicians who will say it here and there, but imagine Joe Biden saying this in 2021. He wouldn't have the guts. He wouldn't have the guts to say it, to stand up to the leftist mob of his own party and say, wait a second here. Now, Trump said it. And to his credit, Trump said it. Robert E. Lee was a great man, great American. He was a great general. He said it to his credit. And of course, look how the left attacked. Now, Trump just, blew him off. So Trump, for all the things that were wrong with Trump, this is one of the good things you can say about him, that he was at least willing to stand up for things and say, wait, you know, people had said this guy was a great general, a great hero. I mean, you know, we need to understand, not just tear down. But not just on the lips of our national leaders, but in the public imagination, the popular media, and in Hollywood, the South, and in particular Southerners in the war for Southern independence, were treated largely with respect, if not outright admiration. Southerners had fought nobly and honorably and were depicted as much in works of literature by movie makers and by our political leaders. Hollywood gave us not only a cinematic treatment of Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind, but numerous other pro-Southern and Confederate-friendly films. Who of a certain age cannot recall such major Hollywood products as Jesse James with Tyrone Power and Henry Fonda in its sequel, The Return of Frank James, or any of several epics starring Errol Flynn, Santa Fe Trail, and Rocky Mountain, or several other memorable John Ford-directed masterpieces, Judge Priest, The Sun Shines Bright, and The Prisoner of Shark Island from 1936. And most actors in Western movies, John Wayne, Randolph Scott, Joel McRae, Audie Murphy, and others, carry the theme of Southern honor and respect into that popular genre. In fact, in the classic Western, I would suggest that there exists a subgenre, which I would call the Southern Western, essentially using the war and its aftermath as a plot basis for dozens of films, a trend that has continued in a small way into more recent times with the continued fascination with Jesse James and the border conflicts, i.e. the Long Riders, Ride with the Devil, American Outlaws, and the assassination of Jesse James by coward Robert Ford. The Great Civil War Centennial of 61 to 65, with its commemorations and celebrations, marked the end of the bargain between North and South, a final salute to the South as a noble adversary in the late unpleasantness. Dramatic changes in American culture and the way many Americans saw themselves in the 60s and 70s would alter Southerners' attachment to the old Democratic Party, perhaps just as significantly radically transform the Northern branch of the party into something incompatible with the views of most Southern folk. But even as late as the 1960s, John F. Kennedy had a successful Southern strategy, which enabled him to win the election in 1960 with Southern votes, despite his later alterations and the turnaround of President Lyndon Johnson. But in many ways, this was the last hurrah for the solid Democratic South. The rise of Goldwater Republicanism Kevin Phillips' Southern Strategy, outlined most notably in his 1969 book, The Emerging Republican Majority, and the emergence of the avowedly conservative Ronald Reagan in 76 and 80, signaled the final demise of the second era of good feelings. Phillips worked closely with President Richard Nixon and outlined his plan to win the South and Middle America for a newly christened conservative and victorious GOP. And by the 70s, and more like a tidal wave in the 80s, conservative Southerners turned Franklin Roosevelt's picture to the wall and became Republicans, at least in their voting habits. The solid Democratic South would continue to be solid, but not Democrat. Increasingly, in the years before the election of George W. Bush in 2000, signs of unease and doubt arose among a few more thoughtful Southerners. Yes, the GOP paid initial lip service to traditional values and commonly held views, which most Southerners shared. But in action, many leaders of the Republican Party, including a new crop of homegrown Southern GOP politicos, think here of Senators Lindsey Graham and Tim Scott of the thoroughly red state of South Carolina, had traveled much further to the definable political and social left, further than many Southern folk realized, even as many blindly followed along. I'd vote for the town drunk if he ran a Republican ticket. And how many times do we hear, I have to vote for the GOP candidate, even if he's terrible, since the Democrat is even worse? Should have been apparent when Graham urged the removal of Confederate symbols from the South Carolina Capitol, or when he essentially endorsed same-sex marriage. But they are just the tip of the political iceberg, the chameleons who inveigle far too many Southern conservatives. Influenced profoundly by the feculent remnants of a zealous Trotskyite globalism and its radical commitment to an expanding concept of civil rights, and by a constant diet of neoconservative commentary spouted by Fox News, Newsmax, and so-called conservative talk radio, incorporating the template and large part Southern Republicanism and establishment Southern conservatives, have largely become indistinguishable from their Northern brethren. How many times each day do we hear representatives of what old right scholar Paul Gottfried calls Con Inc., establishment conservatism, praise the legacy of radical Frederick Douglass, or the vision of communist-inspired Martin Luther King Jr., or Victor Davis Hanson, Mark Levin, and Brian Kilmeade on Fox, Rich Lowry at National Review, Michael Anton and cohorts of the Claremont, Larry Arnn at Hillsdale. You take your pick. They all condemn the historic South, its traditions and heritage. They all accept a warmed-over and refashioned post-Marxist globalism and expansive view of rights, even if they also support Donald Trump. It's a vision that has no room for Confederate symbols and monuments. It's a vision that has led almost all Southern Republican salons and Congress to vote to do away with names of American military installations and forts if they bear the names of Confederate generals or slaveholders. It is, in fact, a neo-Reconstruction, this time led by our supposed defenders who came to power when the old Democrat Party went bad. But as we now find, the leopard has not changed its spots. Despite all the pious campaign promises for this and for that, despite the soothing words of assurance and the pledges to defend what is left of our traditions and heritage, slowly at first, now more rapidly, our reputed defenders have, and when not poisoning progressively our minds and outlook, delivered us over to our very enemies, those very forces that seek our elimination and extermination. I never tire of quoting the great Southern writer Robert Louis Dabney, his superb description of establishment conservatives written 140 years ago, but absolutely applicable today. Here is what he wrote, and I think everybody has to hear this quote. This piece, of course, gets into a lot of these things, and I'll branch out on some of the stuff in a minute, but here's what Dabney wrote. This is a party, established conservatism, which never conserves anything. Its history has been that it demurs to each aggression of the progressive party and aims to save its credit by a respectable amount of growling, but always acquiesces at last in the innovation. What was the resisted novelty of yesterday is today one of the accepted principles of conservatism. It is now conservative only in affecting to resist the next innovation, which will tomorrow be forced upon its timidity, and we will be succeeded by some third revolution to be denounced and then adopted in its turn. American conservatism is merely the shadow that follows radicalism as it moves forward towards perdition. It remains behind it, but never retards it, and always advances near its leader. This pretended salt hath utterly lost its savor. Wherewith shall it be salted? Its impotency is not hard to indeed to explain. It is worthless because it is the conservatism of expediency only, not of sturdy principles. It intends to risk nothing serious for the sake of truth and has no idea of being guilty of the folly of martyrdom. It always, when about to enter a protest, very blandly informs the wild beast whose path it essays to stop that its bark is worse than its bite, that it only means to save its manners by enacting its decent role of resistance. The only practical purpose which it now subserves in American politics is to give enough exercise to radicalism to keep it in wind and to prevent its becoming pursy and lazy from not having nothing to whip. How true, how prescient, how totally and equally valid today in 2021. Until Southern folk consciousness of their heritage and traditions comprehend what has and is coming, until they, we, become far more discerning and willing to stand forth and demand an accounting, the same rot, the same inevitable hemorrhaging, the same putrefaction of the South we love, the South we remember, the South now rapidly slipping away, will continue. The efforts of such enterprises as the Abbeville Institute, Clyde Wilson's Reckoning.com, journals such as Chronicles Magazine, are laudable and to be strongly encouraged, but they are still far from being well known. Every Southerner, aware of who he is, remembering who we are, to use the late Mal Bradford's phrase, should become a true missionary for a reconversion of our people before that becomes an impossibility in the behemoth state we now inhabit. The pro-Southern poet Robert Lee Frost, in his poem The Black Cottage, sums up both hope and our task. For, dear me, why abandon a belief merely because it ceases to be true? Cling to it long enough, and not a doubt, it will turn true again, for so it goes. Most of the change we think we see in life is due to truth being in and out of favor, and I sit here, and oftentimes I wish I could be monarch of a desert land I could devote and dedicate forever to the truths we keep coming back and back to. That must be our task, our role, to keep our heritage alive, our past, our memory, to re-educate ourselves to the truths we keep coming back and back to before our ancestors and before Almighty God. So I like this piece a lot, and I think because it does some things, it explains some things about the South and where we're going in the South and, of course, the Southern tradition. What is valuable in that? Why did Southerners, I mean, they were abandoned by the Democrats. The Republicans had never been their ally. And Ron Kennedy wrote a piece on Tuesday about this. They actually had it on their website. About what to do about this. He talks about the fact that Republicans voted in large numbers to take down statues in the U.S. Capitol of Southerners. And they did it willfully and willingly and gleefully. In fact, pointed out that these were Democrats anyways. Who cares if they come down? Because it's all about Democrat and Republican, not about truth and principle and right and wrong. You can't have that. So I think that is something we have to understand. And they have, if you click on, we put the first part of it on the website. If you click on the link, it says continue reading. It takes you to their page where they have some advice on perhaps what to do about this. But we seek to understand here, to explore what's true and valuable. And certainly there are things that are true and valuable in the Southern tradition that are being lost. And they're being lost because people won't stand up for them. And they don't really care about them anymore. We get emails all the time from people. Hey, I was so ashamed of being Southern, but I started reading your stuff, and I found that, my gosh, there's people out there that are actually proud of the Southern tradition. They're proud of things in the South. There are things that are positive about this, things that are positive about people in the South. Wow, maybe I need to be positive about what I have too. It's very hard to get worn down by this stuff, trust me. When you do this and you put your voice out there and you put yourself out there, people attack you relentlessly. And it's easy to get worn down. It's easy to say, oh man, this is too much. I don't really want to do this anymore. There's always days like that. But you got to remember there's more people out there than what you realize, and there's people out there that think the right way. We don't want to have these things taken down. We don't want to have this stuff going. We want to preserve things. There are things that are good about the South that we want people to understand. And what does a Southern tradition offer to America? To a 20-year-old or a 30-year-old, what can the Southern tradition offer? Well, I think one of the most important things to answer that question is this Jeffersonian tradition of self-government, independent people. I mean, this is what the old Republicans wanted. They wanted an independent citizenry, people that had their own land, people that were as much debt-free as possible. And, of course, there's all kinds of ways out there. I mean, you can get into other programs and other things to try to do that for yourself, and it's very difficult, but people can do it. Particularly if you start young, and if you're in your 20s, you can start that. You don't have to go down the path of Hamiltonianism. You could start out with no debt. You could start out from a position of power and use that to your advantage. A position of power. Even people that have hard financial circumstances can be debt-free. And so when you have that position of power, nobody can control you. I remember Rush Limbaugh years ago, well, he said this, and he said something about somebody told him, and Rush Limbaugh had his own problems, but this is something that always stuck with me. He said that somebody hoped that one day he would have enough money that he didn't have to worry about being dependent on somebody so that they could control what he said, that he could just say what he wanted and there was no repercussions. And I mean, I think that's really the essence of independence, being able to say what you believe and say what you want with no repercussions, because it didn't matter. They couldn't cancel him. And there's a talk show host now, Joe Rogan, who's kind of in the same position. People hate this guy, but they can't cancel him. He has too many followers, too much money. He can do what he wants. He's too powerful. So they hope that Limbaugh would eventually have that one day. And maybe one day we'll have an opportunity. You know, the Institute is based on your contributions. So we only exist if you give us things. And we only have people that can do things because you help financially support the Institute. But that independence for a millennial, for somebody, you know, political decentralization, thinking locally, acting locally, like I say on my own podcast. And if you read that Kennedy piece about going in and doing some things to try to affect your local community and your local political leaders, these are things you can learn from the Southern tradition. Certainly, music, literature, beautiful parts of the Southern tradition that you can embrace and enjoy. They can't take that away from you. This is why we do so much with music. We had a whole summer school on it one time. We had three straight summer schools on Southern literature, because they can't take those things away. If they can try, and really they can't take the political side away either, the Jeffersonian political side, because that is the basis of the entire United States. So at the end of the day, all the power is on the Jeffersonian side. It's all there. All the evidence is there. It's all there. This is why the Nationalists tried to tear it down constantly, because they knew they couldn't do it through the system. They had to work around the system. This is where John Marshall comes into play. The Supreme Court, the federal court system, and around the Constitution, heavy-handed executive power, all that stuff. It's all just a fabrication. It's not real. So all the evidence is on our side. It's just that you have to find it and then be positive about it. Hey, you want to know what's great about music? It's all Southern. This is wonderful stuff. Look at all these things. It doesn't matter about race or anything. It's just music. And I think that's one of the great things, or literature and the themes in literature. And, you know, remind people when somebody says, oh, that's, you know, food. Oh, that's, if you're in the North and you see that's soul food. That's not soul. That's Southern food. That's what that is. It's Southern food. Remind people of how important and vital that Southern tradition is and how beautiful it is. See, back in the 70s, there was this, you know, Southern Renaissance. It was great to be Southern. That can come back. I mean, it can be great to be Southern again. Just don't be apologetic all the time. What are you apologizing for? Apologizing for being something that's great? Why would you do that? Why would you apologize for that? You shouldn't. To have in your lineage as a Southerner, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, James Monroe, George Mason, Patrick Henry, John Marshall, to have that in your patrimony, John C. Calhoun, one of the greatest men in American history. Why? And we could go down the list. Why would you apologize for that? There should be no apology needed. In fact, it should be, wow, this is a great thing. And that's just there. I mean, we can continue in all the Southerners that have been so important in American history. No one should apologize for any of this. That those people made decisions and did things for themselves at the time they thought was right. And we have to do things at the time now for what we think is right and make decisions for what we do. But it doesn't mean you can't admire and respect them and also take pieces of what they said and what they did and say, this is good or this is not good. This is what Livy said the job of the historian is. the Roman historian Livy. This is what he said. So this is why studying the Southern tradition is important. Be proud of it. Be proud of what it is. Symbols, monuments, the core substance of it. Be proud of all of that stuff because it is so important. And so I say all that, and I want to wrap up with a piece that we bookend the Monday to the Friday piece, and it was by Jim Kibler, who's one of our great poets. The title of this poem is Monuments. It's very short, only three stanzas, but he wrote this Memorial Day 2021. I didn't get it till recently, so we put it on the website this week. He says, "Their carven words all testify of then and now and future time that these were they who kept the cause was given them by fathers past and living still in coursing blood. They token men, true to lineage. To sons they left high honor and the land, a legacy of action speaking still. Let stone forever warn the men who sit in marble halls that sires are only seeming dead. They hover near in gray embattled lines beneath thorn, pennon's scarlet flash. And principles remain beyond their flesh and ours, beyond the stone." And when he sent this to me, he said, "Hey, would you put this up and would you put a picture of a monument being taken down?" So the image is of the Lee Monument in New Orleans being taken down. It doesn't matter. You can take all the monuments down, but the stone still stands. It's beyond the stone. Beyond the stone. Their carven words all testify of then and now and future time that these were they who kept the cause was given them by fathers past and living still in coursing blood. They were just following in the Anglo-American tradition. That was important, the Anglo-American tradition. Men of action in a time of action. And that will, it doesn't matter if you take these things down, that can last because you still have this poem, you still have the music, you still have the culture. And that's really what matters. And so be proud of these things. That's what Charlie Daniels said. Be proud you're a rebel because the South's going to do it again. And of course, that was the 1970s. Don't apologize. Apologize for what? Nobody has anything to apologize for now at all. Just be proud of these things that the South contributed so much to America. In so many different ways. And that was something that Southerners hammered constantly. They didn't play defense, they played offense. It's time to play offense and start talking about positive things and not react to all the stupidity that goes on all around. Just start pushing the positive at all times. And we can put the things up that are negative, but the point is, try to be as positive as possible at all times because that's playing offense. And don't always respond to their stupidity. It's not worth it. So I hope you enjoyed this week in review at the Abbeville Institute. Until next time, good day.